that I like to fool around at work, right? And I might even, you know, I might even cross the line a bit. But the last thing that I want to do is make you uncomfortable. I mean, it's just not professional, you know? And I pride myself on being a professional. So from now on, what I would like you to do is just tell me, you know, when and if I cross the line. Okay?
Okay. Now,
Jennifer Aniston in the movie Horrible Bosses, in another scene we're looking at a lot differently now. Brett Ratner was a producer on that film. The Los Angeles Times is reporting six women have accused him of sexual harassment, including actress Olivia Munn. Ratner, through an attorney, has categorically denied all the allegations. It's been less than a month, if you can believe it, since news about Harvey Weinstein's alleged sexual assaults and harassment first came out. Since then, there have been many, many new names in the headlines, some from Hollywood, others from media, science, government, other industries. Glenn Whipp is a staff writer for the LA Times. He broke the story about allegations against director James Toback. Hi, Glenn.
Hello.
So how did these allegations against Brett Ratner, how did they come to the LA Times?
In the wake of the Toback story, there were a number of women who had had encounters or who said they had encounters with Toback at Ratner's house. So there was kind of a natural connection going forward.
Yeah, because they're friends, right, Ratner and Toback?
They are good friends, and apparently and also, Toback would stay at Ratner's house when he was in Los Angeles.
And Ratner also says that Polanski, Roman Polanski, is a friend of his.
Yeah, there was a very infamous quote from an interview in January where he counted Polanski and James Toback, Robert Evans, Warren Beatty as his close friends and mentors, people he's learned from.
Okay, so the Times is reporting six women are accusing him of sexual harassment, misconduct, one sexual assault in at least one case. Can you talk about what they're saying?
Well, again, just very inappropriate behavior, ranging, you know, on the spectrum of harassment to assault, as you say, on set, at parties, industry events, and this, you know, we've also spoken to people who are not comfortable in going on the record, so I would expect that, as with the Toback story, once this has now broken, you're going to see a lot more people come forward.
Right. Well, when you and I talked last week, 38 women had come forward. But then, even as we were talking, you were getting texts and emails from more women. How many women have now contacted you about James Toback?
I always err on the conservative side on that number because the emails just keep coming. I received two more this morning. I think the number would be safe to say about 325 total, including the original women.
325.
Yeah, I mean, his behavior, it would seem that for decades this was just a regular thing for him, just approaching women on the streets of New York and Los Angeles, airports, wherever, and trying to hit on them, usually using the line, I think you'd be great in a movie, I have a part for you. And then it would go from there.
Now, you've written about, you know, writing about Harvey Weinstein and his movies and being on the receiving end of many of his tirades and abusive behavior, of course, none of it sexual. So is any of this surprising to you?
Well, with Toback, the volume of it is just staggering.
Yeah.
I can't believe the response I've received. With Ratner, I mean, these stories have been floating around for quite some time. Olivia Munn wrote about him and an encounter with him that we used in the story. She wrote about it anonymous, you know, not naming him, in a book, and he admitted a year later that it was him. So it's the kind of behavior that, you know, it's been kind of treated in a glib way, you know, Hollywood being Hollywood, for a while now, and now it's just being taken, as it should be, much more seriously.
Glenn Whipp, staff writer for the LA Times, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Ratner, as well as NPR's senior news chief Michael Oreskes, are just the latest men to face multiple allegations of sexual misconduct in the wake of the Weinstein story. Ratner has denied all the claims through his attorney. Oreskes, though, resigned today after three women accused him of harassment. And as more women feel empowered to come forward with their stories of assault and harassment, workplaces are having to reassess how they handle these claims. Jennifer Drobak is a professor at Indiana University. She teaches sexual harassment law, and she has also practiced law in California, where she focused on employment issues. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Also joining us, Erin Gloria Ryan, senior editor at The Daily Beast. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, Jennifer, let's begin with you. When Mike Oreskes worked at The New York Times, he kissed two women who were looking for jobs. And more recently, during his time at NPR, he had an inappropriate conversation with a producer there. He really didn't go as far as Harvey Weinstein, not even close. So how does a manager handle that?
So the rules are you cannot touch people inappropriately at the workplace. Moreover, you cannot engage in sexual banter, tell sexual jokes. Now, not all of this behavior will arise to the level of being actionable under the California Fair Employment and Housing Act or Title VII. And so the question is the context. Is there a consensual relationship? Does the listener find this offensive? Because if the listener is perfectly happy to listen to this, there isn't a problem. But if any of the listeners in the group are offended by the behavior, then it could rise to a level where human resources needs to deal with it.
Well, what is actionable? What is something that goes too far?
Sure. The behavior under many of these standards has to be not only unwelcome, but it has to be severe or pervasive. So that means that there's an inverse relationship between the severity and the pervasiveness of the behavior. So if it's a sexual assault, that once is enough. If it's sexual banter or discussion of sexual prowess, then you're going to need more of that kind of behavior to have a terminable offense or to have a violation of a statute. So it's really a case-by-case analysis. But employees should feel emboldened and within their rights to complain about any kind of behavior to HR so that HR can keep track of this. Now, there are people who are clueless who just need to be educated. Look, you can't discuss that. You could do this, you know, when you were in high school, maybe, but even then, it's if you're not trained, you may not know. And so people can be counseled. And if they are seriously remorseful, they now understand, they could make an apology, then everyone moves on. But there's a difference between someone who's clueless and someone who's a predator. And we're talking about predators mm-hmm. in most of these cases.
Yeah. Well, Erin, can you weigh in on that? Because it seems like a lot of men are being accused these days, and there is a spectrum. There are the Weinsteins mm-hmm. and the Ratners, and then there are the Oreskes who, may not be as extreme and yet are being swept up in this whole thing.
Sure. I think that what we're seeing right now is step one in a many, many step and very long process. Step one is women coming forward and saying, this happened to me and I don't like it. I think a lot of men who weren't aware of this didn't maybe know how pervasive it was or that women didn't like it. Now they don't have an excuse. Like, they've been educated. They've been told we don't like it. I also think one thing that predators that they traffic on is that predators tend to be repeat offenders, and all women have tended to had an interaction with this. So, I mean, by that I mean a higher percentage of women have experienced harassment than a percentage of men have harassed. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's rarer for a man to have harassed than for a woman to have experienced harassment
right.
because we have people like James Toback harassing dozens and dozens of women over the course of years. So I think what's interesting from this is so that men now know that women are experiencing this en masse, and the next step is us figuring out what it means to adequately respond to different degrees of harassment.
And okay, so what do you think is the next step in this conversation? And, you know, a lot of people are wondering at work, maybe, what do I do? How do I interact with women? A lot of men are wondering this. Like, how should I behave now? Can I say anything to her or will I be perceived as a harasser? What if I like a woman at work and I really do want to ask her out? Do I dare?
I think that's a really interesting question, and a lot of men are asking themselves that. But, you know, men, friends of mine, acquaintances of mine who have reached out to me and said, you know, am I okay? Am I messing up? Am I doing something wrong? I think that the fact that you're asking yourself that question means that you are not a lost cause. I also think that, you know, one thing to keep in mind, as the other guest mentioned, the severity of the offense matters. So, you know, if a man does something where he maybe says something that wasn't received well and is warned about it, then he knows not to do that again. You know, but he's not going to get fired over one errant comment. So I think that it's going to be a painful process for some people. I think it's going to be an easier process than a lot of people think.
And Jennifer, I mean, you said that women should go to HR if they feel harassed or they feel that something is wrong. But in the real world, if you will, HR is set up to protect a company. And often the men who are doing these actions or who are repeat harassers are people at the very top, people who have a lot of power, and that women feel like they wouldn't have any recourse necessarily by going to HR. So in reality, what are women to do when they're faced with this incredible power imbalance?
Okay, well, there are a couple of things they can do. First of all, they can, if they have the resources, they can go to a lawyer and learn what their rights are, more particularly to their case. So many lawyers will work on a contingency fee basis, or they'll do an initial consultation for a reduced rate. If a woman or an employee can't find an attorney to give them advice or can't afford it, then they can go to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing or the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and that person can ask questions, can get advice about how to proceed. I would still go to HR, however, having gotten some training on basic rights, because in protecting the company, HR should be handling the matter. That happened at NPR, and it will happen at most companies. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, you'll have HR make a mistake itself and or somehow try and minimize the situation. And if a employee knows her rights and sees that that's happening, then they can know to stop with HR and really go to these different avenues for more follow-up.
I also wonder, though, if the legal profession needs to also be looking at itself, because as I was reading that LA Times story about Brett Ratner and Olivia Munn, she wanted to go to a lawyer, went to a lawyer, and the lawyer advised her against filing a claim, saying she was just this up-and-coming actress and she was going to go up against this powerful guy and it would ruin her career. That was the advice she was given, not to file a claim.
Right, and here's why. There's often a problem in filing a claim. Well, several problems. First of all, when you file a lawsuit, the only thing that you can recover is money damages, unless the case is resolved informally, in which case the attorney can get more creative and request something like an apology or some other type of an accommodation. But when you file a lawsuit, all the law will give you is money. And looking at these situations, you may be able to get some money for pain and suffering or for some type of job injury if you weren't promoted. But some of these cases will not result in damage amounts that are that high. And so then the question becomes whether or not the potential recovery is worth the hassle and the reputational damage that could be caused just by bringing the lawsuit.
Mm. And Aaron, one more thing. You know, I'm wondering about a backlash, a retrenching, if you will. And I'm thinking mm-hmm. about the conversation around campus sexual assault, where initially there was this movement to make it easier for women to have their claims investigated. And now we're seeing a backpedaling of that. Is there a risk of the same thing happening here?
Yeah, there absolutely is a risk. And I think that that's something that's one way in which this moment can learn from a previous moment that felt like a watershed moment for women, is that, you know, one of the things that's really important, it's important for women to feel emboldened to step forward, but it's also important for people to understand that evidence is needed in order for action to be taken against individuals. So women can protect themselves if they're having, you know, problems at work. They should make sure that there's a paper trail. They should be taking screen caps. They should be doing everything they can to make sure that it's never just their word against somebody else's. And I think that that's one of the ways that this movement could actually be more successful is because there's usually a trail when it comes to sexual harassment that isn't necessarily there when it comes to campus sexual assault.
Erin Gloria Ryan, senior editor at The Daily Beast. Jennifer Drobak is a law professor at Indiana University. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, open enrollment for Obamacare begins today. Why the Trump administration seems to not want people to sign up. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Open enrollment for Obamacare kicks off today. It's expected to be a chaotic sign-up season. It looks like the Trump administration is trying to get as few people as possible to sign up. They've cut the enrollment period nearly in half. They're closing the main website, healthcare.gov, for 12 hours most Sundays during that period. They've gutted the budget for advertisement and outreach, and they've ended some subsidies that help low-income people afford the plans. President Trump has claimed Obamacare is dead. Well, he may be killing it from the inside. Here to tell us what to expect from this year's open enrollment is Paul Demko. He covers healthcare for Politico. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So what are insurers expecting this open enrollment period? What are they saying?
Well, I think most people are expecting less enrollment is the bottom line. I mean, insurers are stepping up in some instances and spending additional money on outreach and marketing to kind of, you know, cover for those cuts that the Trump administration has made to marketing and outreach efforts. So we'll see if, you know, they're capable of kind of overcoming that hurdle. And, you know, in some instances, you have states that also are kind of stepping up to the plate and spending more money on those outreach and marketing efforts.
And is the White House open about what it's doing? Does it want to bleed Obamacare by getting as few people as possible to sign up for it?
It's really confusing. The signals have been so muddled and mixed that it's hard to really say. I mean, as you pointed out, you have the president himself repeatedly saying things like Obamacare is dead and just ignoring the fact that, you know, 20-some million people get coverage through expanded Medicaid and the marketplaces. But on the other hand, you have, you know, a whole federal bureaucracy, many of folks who have worked on Obamacare implementation for years that seems to be kind of, you know, going along like nothing's changed. So it's tough to see exactly what the goal is here, but I think the end result is a lot of confusion and mixed messages for consumers who already, you know, there's a lot of evidence, aren't real sophisticated about trying to navigate these markets and understand what their options are.
So safe to say President Trump won't be going on late night comedy shows to get people to sign up.
I think that's definitely fair to say. I mean, that was, you know, a hallmark of the Obama administration where you had the president himself, you know, notoriously going on Between Two Ferns, but also, you know, folks throughout his administration kind of fanning out across the country doing local radio, stuff that, you know, wouldn't even be on your radar screen unless you're in that market. You're certainly not going to see that. You're going to see the exact opposite, which is the repeated, you know, messaging of sort of doom and gloom and the need for repealing and getting rid of this law.
Would this also affect people who have already signed up?
Well, they, you know, that's one of the things that is going forward as we speak is the automatic re-enrollment. So if you do nothing, you will be automatically re-enrolled in a plan. So the thinking is that, you know, most people who are in coverage currently, probably upwards of 80%, will remain covered. And that's in part because of automatic re-enrollment. It's in part because of, you know, almost, you know, 85% of exchange customers are subsidized and therefore protected from some of the big premium increases we're seeing. So there's not a lot of incentive for them to drop coverage if they're not going to be on the hook for any more, you know, additional monthly payments.
So they're protected, but the insurance companies are not because Trump recently decided to cancel cost-sharing reductions. And these were the payments the government gave to insurers to help pay for insuring low-income people. And so does that mean that these insurers will just pass on these as rate increases to everyone else?
That's exactly right. I mean, insurers are going to take a short-term financial hit for the rest of this year. There's no way they could account for this action that Trump took earlier this month for the rest of this year. So they do get a hit there. But then for 2018, the president, I think, waited so long to do this that insurers had to price conservatively and regulators had to take action kind of assuming that these payments might go away. And so you've seen insurers be able to kind of price them into the market and in some places, including California, come up with some pretty innovative solutions to try to protect customers from these big rate hikes, specifically by loading all of the increases onto the silver, not to get too far in the weeds, but the silver plans.
Yeah.
On the exchange. So in California, you're going to have a 12.4% surcharge on those plans to make up for those payments, but the other plans often on the exchange should not be affected by it.
So if you have a silver plan in California, you're out of luck? Are you going to shop for a new plan or what?
Yeah, I think that's the message that insurers and consumer advocates and everybody is trying to spread, that you need to shop. Don't just let automatic enrollment hop. And there's a lot of kind of weird dynamics in this market because of some of the steps that were taken to accommodate the removal of the cost-sharing reduction payments. So you really need to get on the website and see what your options are and understand what the coverage options are. And that's another concern with some of the cuts to, the outreach staff, is there's just not going to be as many folks who are out there to help people understand what their best coverage options are.
And then the people who don't qualify for subsidies, they're not going to be insulated from rising premiums, not just the silver plans, but everyone.
Yeah, those people are the ones who I think already have faced a very tough market. If you're above 400% of poverty and you're shopping in the individual market in a lot of states, it is very, very challenging. States like Iowa and North Carolina and Arizona, where premiums have really skyrocketed. I mean, California is one of the exceptions where rate hikes have been, fairly muted. But for unsubsidized folks, it's definitely going to be a tough market.
So politically, how does the president and the Republicans, how do they not escape the wrath of the voters who are really concerned about rising health care costs?
Yeah, this is a mystery of the president's thinking. I mean, he keeps kind of acting as if Democrats are going to take the blame if these markets implode, and the polling data just doesn't back that up. I mean, the Kaiser Family Foundation has done polling month after month after month on who will get the blame if there are problems with these markets going forward, and overwhelmingly, by almost 2-to-1 margin or about a 2-to-1 margin, people say Republicans. So it's not really clear to me why the president thinks he and his fellow Republicans will escape political damage if these markets, have a lot of problems.
Paul Demko covers healthcare for Politico. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Coming up, after 9/11, journalist Susie Hansen moved to Istanbul, Turkey, to try to better understand Islam and Islamic extremism. She found out that she also had a lot to learn about America and its place in the world.
What I was disturbed by was just how much the foreigners knew about us and our country and our history and our shared history, and how little we knew about them. And I think that they're also surprised by that.
Seeing America from a Foreign Perspective, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. New York has suffered what's being described as yet another terrorist attack. 8 people killed, 11 injured by a rented truck driven down a bicycle path. The suspect, Saifullo Saipov from Uzbekistan, reportedly yelled in Arabic, "God is great." And law enforcement says a note in Arabic found near the truck pledged allegiance to ISIS. The attack took place near the World Trade Center site. It's been 16 years since the 9/11 attacks. And since then, people around the world have become familiar with this narrative of innocent people killed by Muslim extremists in the name of jihad. But back in 2001, it was a new concept, at least for Americans. We had a much more limited understanding of Islam and its extremist elements. Who are these people, we asked, and why do they want to kill us? Journalist Susie Hansen found the answers unsatisfying. So to learn more, she eventually moved to Istanbul, Turkey, and she's been living there ever since. She recounts her experiences in a new book. It's called Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, how did you first end up in Turkey? You ended up getting some kind of fellowship through this organization called the Institute of Current World Affairs, which
yes.
I confess I'd never heard of.
That's not unusual.
Being an American and all. So how did you get to Turkey?
So I applied for this fellowship when I had been living in New York. I was an editor. I had been living there throughout my 20s. I was about 29, and I had started to feel as though there was something about the world I didn't understand. That was mostly because of September 11th. I had been living in New York during September 11th, and there was this period of engagement, and everybody was reading books about the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but it seemed like that faded at some point. And I still was very shaken by the experience, I think, and sort of felt, okay, I've never really lived in the rest of the world. There's something I don't understand. And as someone from the Jersey Shore, I had always imagined that, of course, New York was going to be the place where all the most sophisticated people were, and I was going to understand everything from living there. But that didn't feel actually quite right to me once I had been there for 7 years. So I chose Turkey for a strange reason. It didn't have anything specifically to do with Turkish politics, which was something I was sort of embarrassed to admit at first. But my favorite writer at the time was James Baldwin, and I had seen on a documentary that he said that he felt more comfortable as a black gay man in Istanbul than in Paris or New York, which was very surprising. And I wondered what Baldwin had found when he moved there. So that was actually the main reason. And I moved there without ever having been there, and stayed there for 10 years.
What was it like when you first got there?
It was a beautiful city, and it just was unlike any other place I had ever been, and it had a ton of energy. It felt like the center of the world. It felt like it was moving in this very interesting direction, because at the time, of course, Turkey was moving in a very positive direction, and sort of felt like actually New York was in the past, and Istanbul was moving into the future, and Turkey was moving into the future, and new ideas, creative ideas were going to be found there. So it was absolutely exhilarating, and that was the first 4 or 5 months, and then I was very confused after that and began to have a very difficult time, mostly because it was a very difficult place to understand. And I was starting to realize that I had a lot of weaknesses and biases, and there were a lot of things preventing me from seeing the country on its own terms.
Your dad emailed you, and I'm just going to quote what he emails you. He's kind of upset that you're going to Turkey, and he says, "Did you know that Turkey is 99% Muslim? Are you out of your mind?"
Yes.
Is what he writes. And then you write back, "In Turkey, they restrain Islam. They make women take their headscarves off and put them in a box before they are allowed to enter university campuses." So this idea of Islam for you is something that you had to really come to grips with, this idea that Islam could be restrained, the idea that if you just put it in a box with the headscarves, everything will be okay.
Yeah, I mean, I should explain there that what I was revealing in that statement was that I was trying to reassure him. So, but I think that a part of me meant that I believed, as a kind of good liberal in a way, that this Islam had become a problem that we had to solve. These are things I never would have articulated, and I want to make that very clear. In a lot of ways, I never would have been able to analyze it in that moment, and I would have been embarrassed to admit it. But I do think that, especially at that time, that post-September 11th time, there was this impulse on the part of the liberal community to sort of feel like, okay, what are we going to do about this clash of civilizations? And there's something that we're going to have to fix about it. I think that's basically the impulse. And I think that I saw Turkey, which had been going through this very fascinating debate and struggle between Islam and secularism, so I thought. I mean, that was how I perceived it. Well, this is almost like a laboratory for these ideas. And that was kind of how I viewed the place when I moved there, which I come to realize is quite dangerous, because it's as if
you're scrutinizing it for your own aims, but you're not really seeing it on its own terms. And this realization was the beginning of when I started to reconsider basically, you know, my entire worldview.
Because what we know about Turkey is that it is at the crossroads between East and West. We hear that a lot, especially with Istanbul.
Yes.
And that Ataturk modernized the country, 100 years ago, and brought it into the modern era, shunned all of its kind of Islamic trappings to make it more westernized. And that is something that we in the West embraced.
We saw it as a good thing. We saw it as a good thing then. We saw it, and people were sort of trotting it out as an example right before the lead up to the invasion of Iraq. Is okay. What we're going to have to do is find a sort of strong man, you know, benevolent strong man like Ataturk, and that's the only person who's going to wrest Iraq into, you know, decent shape. And of course, you know, Ataturk was a dictator, and you know, a lot of people died during this revolution and the establishment of the Turkish Republic, and also there was a kind of vast suppression of ethnic and religious identities, which of course there's always going to be a backlash to that. And, I mean, what I could see once I got there was that there had been a real sense of loss. You know, people had lost a sense of who they were. I mean, they lost their language to a certain degree. They lost the way to dress, the way to interact in public. And so that's going to leave a very kind of dangerous hole behind in people's lives. But it also, I think that what we don't tend to talk about when we talk about Turkey was that it was an authoritarian country for almost all of its existence. And how could this possibly be a liberal democratic model that Americans would admire? I mean, a brutal authoritarian country run by a military. But for a very long time, especially during the Cold War, the United States especially was very, very happy to have this military in charge because it was keeping Turkey on our side and preventing them from, you know, turning towards the Soviet Union when there really was probably not a very big chance that was ever going to happen.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Susie Hansen. She's the author of the new book, Notes on a Foreign Country and American Abroad in a Post-American World. You're talking about this kind of willful ignorance on the part of America and Americans like yourself when it comes to world affairs and living in other countries. I mean, it has, in a way, always been thus because we are such an isolated, physically isolated country, in a sense. And also, there is this belief that we don't really need to find out more about the world because we are a superpower. For many decades, it was Americans abroad were seen as kind of charming in their innocence and in what you just describe as friendly people who want to get to know, you know, these interesting people that they meet, at least when they're traveling. They do.
Yeah.
I mean, is there something to that as well, that there's a good side to this
kind openness of,
well, this American, I guess, bumbling
friendliness,
bumbling into these foreign places and just kind of trying to figure it out?
I think that you will hear foreigners talk about this openness on the part of Americans. And sometimes I will hear people say, like, Americans are so nice. And so, you know, they're always smiling and they're so. But I think that what I was much more disturbed by was just how much the foreigners knew about us and our country and our history and our shared history and how little we knew about them. And I think that they're also surprised by that, because I would be having these conversations, and I describe one in Greece where I'm being sent there as a journalist to write about the financial crisis. And I say in my sort of, you know, I think somewhat, I don't think I was very arrogant, but it was a somewhat arrogant journalist way when you're sort of being tough, you know, and you say, what happened here? You know, how did you end up in this mess, basically? And it's a little bit accusatory. And I think that eventually they said to me, you know, well, if we're going to talk about how we ended up in this mess, we're going to have to go back to 1946, 1949, the Greek Civil War and the American intervention. And they said, you know what I mean. And of course, I didn't know what they were talking about. And you know, what happened in 1946, 1949? So it wasn't only, though, that I didn't know what they were talking about. I didn't know their history. I didn't know my own country's history in that place. And what that means is, because that was obviously a relationship of power. And I was the beneficiary of that power and have been the beneficiary of that power. And what that meant was that I didn't understand where my own prejudices or where my own views about Greece might be coming from, because I didn't even know the history of this very intimate relationship that we had had for 60 years. And all of a sudden, I started feeling like there was something almost immoral about a foreign journalist going to write about a foreign country and not understanding this history and not understanding what it means and not not ever considering what that history means about our identities and the way that we look at the world. And this was a kind of shattering moment for me, I think.
So you've been in Istanbul for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And do you now understand what James Baldwin saw in the city?
Well, he never wrote about Istanbul. So what he did give interviews to Turkish journalists. And he saw Turkey being used as a ping pong between the United States and the Soviet Union. And this was just the beginning of this, because this was the early 60s, right? And so it was the beginnings of the American Empire. And he was watching this with trepidation, because he said, wait a minute, it's the 60s in America right now. You know, it's the civil rights era. We have not worked out these problems, these very bloody, violent problems in our own country. Why are we casting, you know, ourselves out into the world and preaching that they should be like us, which is essentially what we were doing? And it was then that I realized that there was this really fascinating and very important connection between race relations at home and foreign policy abroad, and that white Americans like myself were at that time in the 60s guilty of not knowing African Americans, not knowing anything. They were in this very intimate relationship, as Baldwin talked about, but they didn't know anything about them, and they would never be able to love them if they did not even know them. And of course, they were also hating them and everything else. But I think that white Americans and even the sort of ideology of the country ended up taking some of that with them when they were abroad. And white Americans, again, replicated this relationship where they have the power, but they don't know anything about the people who they have the power over. And that, I think, was something I wouldn't have been able to see had it not been for Baldwin. That was what he saw. But I think that one of the other questions I had about him was that he always said that the only thing that could solve America's race problem was, I mean, he didn't say solve, but, you know, sort of ease it, was love. And when I was younger, I didn't understand what he meant. I thought this was kind of ridiculous. Well, come on, it's not that simple, you know. But I think that after living abroad and after realizing, like, that we have, again, as I'm saying, this relationship with these people that is kind of, it's kind of amazing to discover. And that when you are conscious of that and you start to care about them, and I'm talking about foreigners, it is a form of love. It's a different kind of love, because you understand them and you're interacting with them more, and you know that you have this shared history. And you're also, you know, learning to understand your own self within that relationship. That is what he meant by this love. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what he meant, but still. But I think that it's funny that I just found that such a difficult concept to understand in the beginning.
Susie Hansen, she's the author of a new book. It's called Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Earlier in the show, we talked about Hollywood's latest set of sexual harassment allegations. Well, it turns out the art world is not immune. Knight Landesman is the former co-publisher of Art Forum. That's the glossy Bible of the art world. He has been accused of sexually harassing women who worked at the magazine. It is a big art world scandal. And when we want to know what's going on in that world, we turn to our frequent contributor, Carolina Miranda. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. Hi there.
Hello.
All right. Tell us about Knight Landesman. Who is he and what is he accused of?
He is one of four publishers at Art Forum, which is, it's not only, it's like the Vogue and the New York Review of Books of the art world all rolled into one. So status-wise, a super important magazine. And he has been accused by a former employee of Art Forum of sexually harassing her while she worked at the magazine and later after she left. And that included unwanted touching as well as some very sexually explicit emails and text messages that I can't really share on
air.
Yeah. They're all filed in. She filed a lawsuit with New York State Supreme Court against Landesman and the magazine, saying that folks at the magazine knew but didn't really do anything about it. And as part of that suit, she included the testimonies of eight women who they alleged that they had had similar encounters with Landesman, including two former Art Forum employees. So it's a very powerful powerful figure at a very powerful magazine within the art world. So it has really rattled things.
Right. And he has resigned or?
He resigned on the same day that Amanda Schmidt, who is the plaintiff, filed her suit. He resigned from the magazine and the magazine issued a statement saying that, you know, that they would be looking at the way the office was managed and establishing a committee to move forward.
But they defended him, right?
Initially, they defended him. Initially, the story started off this way. There was a report on ArtNet, the art news website, talking about how he had been ordered to go into therapy as a result of somebody who had accused him of sexual harassment. The magazine issued a statement saying that the claims were unfounded, quote unquote. The next day, Schmidt filed her lawsuit, and the lawsuit contains these emails and screen grabs of text messages, and they're all quite incriminating if they are indeed his emails. And he resigned that day, and the magazine issued a much more contrite statement saying that, you know, obviously this didn't fit their ideals, their feminist ideals. A lot of women work at the magazine. The editor-in-chief was a woman, and she actually ended up resigning in the wake of the scandal as well, because she said she, you know, didn't feel comfortable being sort of the figurehead of the magazine.
Wow.
In the wake of all of this.
Oh my gosh. Okay. And so this, as you say, is rocking the art world. There's now this online petition or a letter, an open letter signed now by 5,000 women who are in the art world, basically saying we've had enough.
Yes. It's hashtag not surprised, and it resides at its own URL. The Guardian published it on Sunday night. And it was a very searing letter saying that we've essentially had enough, that we have been harassed, we have been belittled. Our ideas have been questioned because of who we are and what we and who we happen to be, and we're done.
You know? Okay.
It's like, we are done.
And Sunday, also coincidentally, Linda Nochlin died, and she was a pioneer when it comes to this. She had written an essay about sexism in the art world back in, 1971?
In 1971, she is the most important turnkey feminist art historian there is. She wrote an essay called Why Are There No Great Women Artists? And she picked apart that question and what that question implies, that somehow women can't be great women artists because of some inherent woman thing that prevents them from being great. And she looked at the history of how women have historically been denied apprenticeships, you know, the mentoring relationships that are so key to developing a skill in art. You know, art is a skill. It's not just some emotional thing that's channeled down from the heavens. That women for centuries were denied access to life drawing classes. They couldn't draw nude figures because it was considered inappropriate. You know, the basis of Western art has been denied to women over the centuries. And so her essay looked at that inequity and talked about, you know, the question shouldn't be why are there no great women artists. The question should be what are the conditions that have led us to this moment? And she looks at those conditions. And those conditions, interestingly, have not changed a lot since 1971. They have changed. Women have greater roles as museum directors. They have a greater presence as successful artists, as critics. But there is still a great inequity. You know, for every 7 male artists that have commercial gallery representation, only 3 women do. Only 3 women lead any of the big museums, the ones with budgets of more than $15 million a year. They on average earn 75 cents for every dollar a man earns in those positions. And so there is still the significant inequity. And part of that is Art Forum, this industry Bible, which since its foundation has featured only 18% of women on its very powerful cover.
Why is Art Forum so powerful? I mean, you know, in the broader journalism world, we talk about the death of print and how it's not important as much as it was, you know, but yet this hefty, thick physical magazine is still a powerful arbiter of what's
everything
in and what's not. Right.
Yeah, of everything.
Why?
I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, it's, you know, as newspapers and other media outlets have shrunk, so has fine art coverage, which makes the art coverage that the art magazines do that much more important, I think.
And do they just anoint who is the valued art stars? Like whoever's on their cover can then command more money, that kind of thing?
There is definitely, you know, are they powerful enough to anoint? I don't know. Usually by the time you get to be on the cover of Art Form,
you're already
pretty anointed by gallery. You know, it's a circle. It's this like echo chamber. It's the powerful galleries, the big museums, the magazines.
And so if you're a woman and you're excluded from the cover and you're excluded from the pages of this magazine.
Yes.
That means that says something.
That says something, and it can affect your financial earnings. It can affect your professional reputation. And that is not to say that the magazine has not covered feminist issues or women artists in the past, because they very much have, and they have had feminist scholars writing for them. But when it comes to the sort of the big glossy cover, which, you know, counts for a lot, it's definitely been a little deficient.
Right. And would Landesman, would he say who would be on the cover and who wouldn't?
Landesman, as publisher, did not have, as far as I understand it, a role in the editorial. That went to the editor-in-chief, the most recent one of which was a woman. That said, I think part of what Linda Nochlin's, what makes Linda Nochlin's essay so important is that she looks at how, you know, you can insert women into these pre-existing structures that were built by men, but it doesn't change the structures. The mechanism doesn't change. And if you have a gallery system and a museum system that is showing mostly men, then as a result, you're going to have media that reflects mostly men. And this system is going to reflect men back and forth to each other. If our idea of an artist is an idea that was established by men, then how do women fit into that?
Great question. Eternal question.
An eternal question. Yeah, we're figuring it out.
Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times and a regular here at Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Christian Bordahl, you have some feedback on this very topic.
I do, and it's all, you know, really thoughtful. So I would suggest that people go to the KCRW.com Facebook page and read through and get involved. But just briefly, Joe Pearson says, harassment exists. It's a fact, like any other form of bullying. It should be rooted out and stopped. However, having my fanny patted by an old man is not bullying. It may be inappropriate, but it's not bullying. And I have a responsibility to tell said old man, stop, or to let it slide. My body, my choice. But if said old man doesn't stop, then I need to take it further. My body, my responsibility. I will not be a victim. I thought that was an interesting thought.
Referring to the former president, the elder
referring
Bush.
Referring to the elder Bush, exactly.
Okay,
yes.
So lots of comments there at, is it the KCRW Facebook?
It's the KCRW Facebook
page,
okay, yep.
Okay, so KCRW Press Play. Check it out. And thank you very much, Christian Bordahl.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.